Here.
I'm happy to announce part two of Ron Donati's lectures. Today's talk is entitled, again, the geometric Langmuir's conjecture, algebra and analysis, classical quantum.
Thank you again, Berger, and thank you all for coming. Since I've people in the audience who weren't here yesterday, why don't I start with a very quick review? So I'll review the basic setup of what the geometric Langlands conjecture is about, and I'd like to talk about one particular approach to it, which is based on abelianization, which will lead me to a little discussion of non-abelian Hodge theory. I will just barely touch on a couple of ideas that have come in recently from quantum field theory, and you should talk to the experts for more details. And hopefully I'll be able to talk a little bit towards the end about some of the results that we really have, which have to do with the classical limit of geometric Langlands. So where yesterday was we did some background material and examples to do with GLN, but then at the end we said that the general form of the correspondence is its conjectural equivalence of categories between two derived categories. One is the bounded derived category of sheaves on the space lock, which is the space parameterizing local systems on a given curve. So we fix a curve C in a structure group G with maximum torus T. And if you're not familiar with the language of groups, you may as well just take G to be GLN, and then T will be the subgroup of diagonal matrices in GLN. Then Gothic G is its Lie algebra, which will be just a set of Orlin Bayan matrices in case of GLN. This is the Lie algebra of the torus, so it's again the diagonal matrices, but here they have they're multiplicative with non-zero entries. Here it's all diagonal matrices with additive structure. And then there are the Langlands dual groups, G Langlands, T Langlands, and so on, which in the case of GLN and in several other cases are identical to the original, while in other cases they are not. And I worked out a table of examples of what the Langlands dual of several well-known groups would be. The characteristic property is that the group G has a lattice of characters, which is the homomorphisms from the maximal torus to C star, which sits sandwiched between two other lattices that depend only on the Lie algebra. And for the Langlands dual, everything is flipped around. So the co-roots of G, which by definition are the dual lattice of the weights, are going to be the roots of the Langlands dual of G. And the co-weights, which are duals to the roots, will be by definition the weights of the Langlands dual, and similarly characters and co-characters get interchanged. So the spaces that occur here in the statement, I'm sorry, there's some junk here. The spaces that occur here are Bern and Lock. Bern is a moduli space of semi-stable principal G bundles on the curve C. And if I write a Langlands dual symbol on Bern, that means that I'm looking at principal semi-stable bundles whose structure group is the Langlands dual group. Again, if you prefer to simplify, just take everything to be GLN, and then you don't have to worry about the group and its dual. Just remember that GLN appears twice in two slightly different roles.
Then you don't distinguish central topology.
I'm sorry?
Then you don't distinguish central and topology. If for GLN, even in that case, center and topology are exchanged. Right?
Center?
And the fundamental group, topology of the group.
Yes, of course. So we had several examples, and we will see more of this today, but the Langlands dual of GLN, as of course you know, is GLN, while if you have a subgroup like SLN, its Langlands dual will be a quotient rather than a sub. So in this case, it will be PGLN. Which, so the map here is an isomorph. Well, there is no map really from the group to Langlands dual, but this group is an enchanted cover of the other one. This one has a non-trivial fundamental group, but has no center. Here, it's the other way around. It has a center, which is Z-mod N, but it's simply connected. So those two features get exchanged. In the case of GLN, well, it just goes to itself. And we saw quite a number of other examples yesterday. So we have the moduli space bun of bundles, and we have the moduli space lock of local systems. For me, a local system will just be a bundle with a flat connection. So that means that's equivalent to a representation of the fundamental group. The representation of the fundamental group gives you a vector bundle together with a local trivialization or a flat connection on the total space of the bundle. So we have bun and lock, and bun L and lock L. And unfortunately, I also need at least a passing mention of the same things with calligraphy letters, bun and lock, etc., which are the corresponding moduli stacks. And you don't really need to know exactly what those are, just remember that somehow they keep track of the fact that the objects you're classifying, the bundles, have automorphisms. And especially if you want to consider not just semi-stable objects, but all objects, then you pretty much are forced to consider geometric objects that are more general than just varieties or schemes because of these jumping phenomena that I tried to mention a little bit yesterday. Okay. So the Langlands conjecture basically says that there is a correspondence C, or an equivalence of categories between these two derived categories. On one side, we have coherent sheaves on the space lock. You can think of the space lock as being some sort of a double of the space bun, right? In terms of its dimension, that is true. The dimension of lock is exactly twice the dimension of bun. And part of the story of non-abelian Hodge theory that I will be getting into tells you that you can really think of this as a deformation of the cotangent bundle of that. So it, in some very reasonable sense, it is a double of that. You start with the space, you take its cotangent bundle, so you get something of double the dimension, and you do something to it. Of course, there's also the little issue that here you have an L and here you don't. So that's not correct. Lock is roughly the double of bun, not of bun L. So that is compensated for by the fact that on this side we take coherent sheaves, while on that side we take D modules. So here we have D modules on the smaller space, here we have coherent sheaves on a space of double the dimension. And if you know a little bit about D modules and support and so on, you know that the size, the amount of information that goes into specifying a D module is roughly the same as what goes into describing a sheaf on the cotangent bundle or a deformation of it. So each side has a doubling going on, but the doublings are in very different places. On one side, it's a doubling of the underlying space. On the other side, it's a doubling of the notion of what kind of sheaf you're looking for. So the crucial behavior that we expect from this correspondence is, from this equivalence of categories, is that it should be compatible with Hecke correspondences. The Hecke correspondence is a subvariety of the product of bun and bun cross C. I'm kind of stuck with having L's on all my spaces just because I didn't have L's on the left, so I do have L's on the right, and the Hecke correspondences are on the right. So sometimes I will not pronounce the L, but it's somewhere in there. The Hecke correspondence is the set of, well, it's a subvariety of the product, so it's a set of triples, V, V prime, and X. I think I have it somewhere here. Here. No. Well, it's V and V prime, or two principal bundles on the curve. X is the point of the curve, and beta is an isomorphism between the bundles away from the one point. So it's allowed to blow up to arbitrary order at the point, which causes this Hecke to be an infinite dimensional object. It's really an int scheme, if you want to be technical about it. And in order to have the illusion of control, you want to slice it into finite dimensional pieces, which would be nice varieties. So we defined these Hecke mus, which are finite dimensional pieces of Hecke. And they were described by this green bracket here. So piece number mu consists of all triples v, v prime, and x, and isomorphism beta, such that in the right setting, in other words, after we apply the corresponding representation rho, the isomorphism becomes an isomorphism of vector bundles that just blows up to a certain order at the point x, and that order has to be bounded uniformly by the inner product of mu and lambda. So mu lives exactly in the dual of the lattice where lambda lives, and that gives you the cutoff. So the fibers of these original projections, P and Q, are infinite dimensional int schemes called the affine Grassmannians, and the affine Grassmannian is filtered by an increasing sequence of finite dimensional pieces, which you would like to think are just ordinary finite dimensional Grassmannians. Actually, the result is that this Hecke mu is going to be smooth if and only if the representation mu, the weight mu, is what's called minuscule. So that means that if you take the weight, you take its orbit under the Weyl group, so you get a certain set in the lattice, you take its convex hull, the only things in the interior are going to be actually on the boundary, or you can allow zero, but nothing else. So it's a very severe restriction. And in fact, for many groups, there are no minuscule weights whatsoever. For GLN, there are some, namely the basic fundamental wedge products of the fundamental representation are minuscule. But those are the only ones that give you nice, smooth varieties. In all other cases, you get singularities, and those singularities force us to go into a fancier world of intersection cohomology chains. So the Hecke operator, which is the integral transform defined by this correspondence, you'd like to say that you take a sheaf like M on one side, you pull it back by one operator and push it down by the other, but that turns out to have bad properties unless you correct it by tensoring with the intersection cohomology, intersection chain complex of this singular variety. So if mu is minuscule, then this thing is just the integers, you can just forget about that. If there are singularities, this is the right way to deal with them. So anyway, there's some geometric operation, which basically means you take the correspondence and see what it defines. You pull back and push forward, and you have to adjust a little bit along the way. It generates this algebra of all Hecke operators. So how big is this algebra? Real big. How many generators do we have? One for each point of the curve and each integer between 0 and n, in the case of GLN. Or in the more general setting, one for each point of the curve and one for each weight in the positive cone. So that's a lot of generators. It's a huge algebra. The set of generators has the cardinality of the continuum. It's not countable. But nevertheless, it turns out this algebra is abelian, and it's a really cute argument. Right, the part that's hard to see is, right, what does this algebra do? It takes a vector bundle on the curve, and it tries to account for all the ways of making a modification of a particular type at a particular point. So you're looking at all other vector bundles, which are isomorphic to the given one everywhere, except at this one point, you make a particular type of change. So in the case of GLN, you're just looking at a subsheaf of where the fiber has codimension I in the given one. And something a little more complicated for other groups. Right, so it's not at all clear why that would commute with a second operation based at the same point. It's not at all clear why those two operations should commute. But what is clear is that if you take this operation at one point and then a different operation at a different point, those two clearly commute with each other because you're just making a change at both points. It doesn't matter in what order you do it. So what that says is that even though it's not clear that an element commutes with another element at the same point, it's clear that it commutes with a dense open subset of the generators, and then by continuity you get that it must commute also in the limit where, which is the one case where you don't really see it. So that's the argument for why this is an abelian commutative algebra. So in particular, you can start asking about simultaneous eigenvalues and eigenvectors for the action of that. So you can try to diagonalize the action of the Hecke algebra, and that is what the geometric Langlands program is about finding automorphic objects, objects that are eigen objects. So you can think of them as eigen sheaves or eigen complexes or whatever, objects in the right category that transform correctly under this. So that pretty much completes the definition of what the problem is, except there's this slight discrepancy, which I think is what Sergei was referring to, which is that the space Bun L is disconnected. Its group of connected components is given by H2 of the curve with coefficients in pi 1 of the group. So that's often non-zero, right? That is just pi, since this is a Riemann surface, it's two-dimensional, that just gives you pi 1 of the group, which is also the dual, I think that's called Pontryagin dual. It's the Pontryagin dual of the center of the Langlands dual. So if we call this LG, then this would be G. So whatever, it's something to do with the center of the group, which may very well be non-zero, right? Certainly not. It's certainly non-zero for GLN or SLN. Right, so that implies that the derived category of all D modules on this monster, well, we don't know much about it, but if the underlying space decomposes into some connected components, the derived category will just be the direct sum of the derived categories on the individual components. Anyway, there's some obvious decomposition of the derived category. On the other hand, this lock space is irreducible. There's no reason for that to break. The reason is that we're looking not at... Right, why did this thing have components? Because you have Chern classes. Different bundles can have different degrees. The degree is the thing that parameterizes the different components. The Chern class takes values in this group. But for a flat object, a bundle with a flat connection, its topology has to be trivial, right? Otherwise, you don't have a flat connection on a curved bundle. The Chern class is the obstruction to having a flat connection. So Locke picks out only one of all these components, so it can't possibly have the full picture in it. So Locke is always irreducible because of the flatness. And therefore, DB lock is, well, it doesn't quite follow it. You don't see any obvious reason to expect that DB lock should decompose in any corresponding way. So that tells you that lock is not good enough. You need to replace it by something bigger, and that turns out to be the stack. So if you take the moduli stack of semi-stable G-local systems instead of the moduli space, well, I haven't told you what a stack is, but you see that I'm putting in more structure, and then there's a chance. So it turns out that indeed Locke, the stack, is an algebraic stack with coarse moduli space, the original one, and there's an open stack, there's an open subset on it of those local systems that are regularly stable, and over that open set, the whole thing is what's called a banded gerb. It has a very uniform description. It's kind of the analog of a bundle, but it's not that you're adding points, you're rather adding automorphisms to your objects. At any rate, that is why in the conjecture we are using the calligraphic lock rather than the straight lock in order to have a chance of actually having an equivalence of categories. So just to go back to the basic example, when G and its Langlands dual are GLN, then a local system, V, is a pair of V-nabla, where V is just a rank n-vector bundle together with a flat connection. the Hecke algebra in this case is generated by the things I was calling HI last time. So among all the weights, there are the basic collection of weights, the fundamental weights, the ones that correspond to the nodes in the Dynkin diagram, if you know what that is. And then those particular Heckes look like this. Hecke I is the set of triples V, V prime, and X, where V containing V prime containing V tensor O of X, and I is the length of the quotient. So this is where we started last time. We covered this as a very special case of Hecke mu for a particular weight mu of this particular group. And in this case, the fiber is indeed aggressive-minded. So this is one example that you can really visualize easily. And then, of course, there's a special case where G is GL1, and then Bun is just a Picard group, and I worked this out for you yesterday in detail. We actually outlined two different proofs of the geometric Langlands conjecture in this abelian case. Okay, so... So I want to move to the abelianization procedure. And I've got to tell the story of how I got into this. This was 19 years ago. I was visiting Arnaud Beauville in Paris, and he was telling, I asked him what he was doing, and he told me, oh, he's writing this little paper with Ramanan on speckle covers. Oh, you never heard about speckle covers? You know, there's this nice new paper of Hitchens you should have a look at. So there was this festschrift for Manin's 50th birthday at the time, 60th? 1987, I forget the round number. But there's an issue of Duke Journal that had the paper in it, so I was flipping through that, and indeed there was a very nice paper of Hitchin about Hitchin's integrable system, which I'll tell you about in a minute. And there was the article right next to it was a very nice survey article by Lomon, where he talks about the geometric Langlands conjecture. So I read this, I read that, and I read this, and I read that, and suddenly I realized that these two guys are really talking about the same thing, that there's got to be a way of putting these two articles together. So that's kind of been an obsession of mine off and on for those past intervening 20 years. Let me try to explain what's going on here. So Higgs is the basic space on which this integrable system lives. A Higgs bundle is a pair of V and phi, where V is a vector bundle, or more generally a G bundle, a principal G bundle on the curve, and phi is a Higgs field. A Higgs field is a canonically valued or one-form valued endomorphism of the vector bundle or a section of the adjoint bundle tensor, the canonical bundle in general. Higgs is the space of all Higgs fields, all Higgs bundles on a given curve. So it's a set of pairs V and phi. It depends, of course, on the curve C and on the group G. By a little bit of deformation theory, you see that the space of Higgs bundles is more or less the same as the cotangent bundle to Bun. In other words, if V is a point of Bun, then formally you can calculate the deformation space, or the dual deformation, the cotangent space at V to Bun, which is going to be given by some cohomology group, and indeed that cohomology group is H naught on C of endomorphisms of V tensored with canonical class. I think I'm calling it omega C. So this cohomology group, right, so this is just the set of phis V to V, blah, blah, blah. The Higgs field. So a Higgs field is just a cotangent direction. Right, but you might be more familiar with the dual version, the dual vector space to this by serduality is H1 on C of the endomorphisms. The omega just comes from serduality, and it interchanges H0 and H1. H1 of the endomorphisms are deformations. That's the tangent space to moduli. I'm writing the dual to that. So so Higgs fields are cotangents to moduli. I didn't say equal. I said wiggle. because the notions of stability are a little different. So these two things are birationally equivalent. At generic points, they're the same. But I haven't even told you what stability means. But I just told you that it's some condition that weeds out the non-Hausdorff behavior, the non-separatedness. So the condition for Higgs bundles turns out to be a little less severe than for bundles. It's possible to have an unstable bundle, but the addition of Higgs field to it makes it stable. So you can have a stable Higgs bundle whose underlying vector bundle is unstable. So it's a better way to say it is that Higgs contains a contingent bundle to Born as a Zariski open subset. It's a closure of it. Anyway, the Hitchin map is a map from the space Higgs to a vector space, which of course depends on the same data, the curve and the group. This vector space turns out to have the same dimension as Born, and therefore half the dimension of Higgs. Right? Higgs behaves like the cotangent bundle, so it's double the dimension. And that makes this into an integrable system. There's a symplectic structure here. The fibers are Lagrangian. They're maximal isotropic. So it's what's called a completely integrable, algebraically completely integrable system. You can write down this vector space explicitly. I'm not sure if that will how easy that is to digest, but roughly what I'm saying is, so the Hitchin map, did I call it H? Goes from the Higgs space to the base space. In the case of GLN, this is going to be the direct sum I going from 1 to n, H naught on C of the canonical bundle to the power I. So it's the direct sum of vector spaces of pluricanonical differentials on the curve. In general, for general group G, let's say R is the rank of the group, which by definition means the dimension of the maximal torus. So the sum would be over R pieces, each of which is some pluricanonical space. The DIs would be the degrees of the basic invariant polynomials for the group. So in the case of GLN, DI is I, for I from 1 to n. In the case of SLN, you'll have degrees from 2 to n, you just miss piece number 1. For orthogonal groups, you have basically even numbers plus the you have different lists of these for different groups. So that is a somewhat non-canonical way to describe the base of the Hitchin system as a space of coefficients of some polynomials. The more intrinsic description that I prefer is to think of it as global sections of a bundle. So the... I'm trying to sneak it in here. Over the curve, you take the canonical bundle. That's a line bundle. So at each point of the curve, the fiber of this is a line. The line varies from point to point. I will tensor it with this fixed vector space, the Lie algebra of the Cartan, the Lie algebra of the maximal torus, also known as the Cartan subalgebra. So this is now a rank R vector bundle over the curve. I will take this bundle and divided by the action of the symmetry group of the situation, which is called the Weyl group. So in the case of GLN, the Weyl group is just a symmetric group interchanging the n coordinates. So what kind of an object did I get here? Well, it's the quotient of a vector space by a finite group. It's a pretty bizarre object. There's a theorem of Chevalet that tells you that this bizarre object is actually a vector space. The identification of it with a vector space is not quite completely canonical, but it works. So up to some discussion in the footnote, you can think of this as a vector space at each point, and therefore this is really a vector bundle over the curve. And it's exactly the existence of these basic invariants that underlies this theorem of Chevalet. To get this to be a vector space is exactly the same saying that the ring of invariants is generated by just a minimal number of generators. So it just says that the ring of invariants is a polynomial in some weighted generators. The weighted generators are these. So in the case of GLN, it's just the fundamental theorem of symmetric functions that does it. So this is some kind of a vector bundle over the curve, and you can take its global sections. If you work out these global sections explicitly, you get this direct sum of spaces of pluricanonical differentials, and I'll skip how you derive that. I'll just have you believe it. But if I work with this description, then the Hitchin map is completely apparent. You just take a pair, V phi, a Higgs bundle, and send it to, well, I want to give you a section of this bundle of quotients. So at each point of the curve, I need to give you a section of the Cartan valued in one form, but it's okay if I have an ambiguity by the symmetry group, the Weyl group. So what is it? It'll just be phi mod W. Right? Phi is an endomorphism. At least generically, I can think of the endomorphism as being diagonalizable, so I can put it in the Cartan. Of course, there's more than one way of diagonalizing it. The ambiguity there is exactly the permutations of the Weyl group in general. So up to the Weyl group, it really works. You could complain that this doesn't quite make sense if at those points where the Higgs field is not diagonalizable, there will be such points. So then you either do a continuity argument or you use another a variant of Chevalet's theorem, which basically tells you that you have the inclusion of the Cartan into the Lie algebra, which gives you a map from the Cartan to the Lie algebra modulo the conjugation action, the adjoint action of the Lie group. If you mod out by the action of the Weyl group on the left, that clearly gets embedded into the action of the group here. So you have a map from T mod W to G mod G, and another version of Chevalet's theorem is that this is an isomorphism. So vice versa, if you have a point of the Lie algebra defined up to conjugation, this allows you to lift it to something in the Cartan defined modulo the Weyl. So that's what I'm really using. Okay. So that's a Hitchin map. And like I said, it makes the this is an integrable system. The fibers are Lagrangian. Turns out that these fibers are abelian varieties. They're complex tori with an algebraic projective structure. In fact, they're almost Jacobians. In the case of GLN, they really will be just Jacobians of curves. In more general situations, there will be what are called prim varieties. So over the base B, there's a family of curves called, depending on the author and the exact context, either spectral covers or camera covers. These are finite covers of the fixed curve C, where the branching and the data really varies depending on the point and the base. And I just wrote for you the definition. There's a map from C cross B to the total space of this quotient that I was dealing with before. That quotient has a universal W cover, which is what you get if you forget the W, and you take the fiber product that gives you a cover here, which is actually a Galois cover, and the Galois group is the Weyl group. So you have a space here which maps to B. Each fiber is a curve, which is a Galois extension, a Galois cover of the curve C with an action with a Weyl group W. The usual spectral covers are some quotients of this thing. So in the case of GLN, this cover has degree n factorial, which is the order of the Weyl group. The speckle cover is usually the n-sheeted cover that's associated to it. So it's just the quotient by the symmetric group on n minus 1 variables. Anyway, so the fiber ends up being an abelian variety that's determined by this curve C sub B, the fiber of this Camerl cover. So we get an integrable system, and I already mentioned that Higgs contains the cotangent bundle to Bern as a Zariski open subset. The idea of abelianization is that, well, this is essentially the idea of, for abelianization. It tells you that you can describe the Higgs bundle, the moduli, the Higgs space, the moduli of Higgs bundles, very, very precisely, in geometrically, in terms of this family of spiral covers. And some of the keywords are you get some group schemes, and you have a torsor, and there's a gerb, and yeah, it takes a while to digest, so never mind. But the basic idea, which is that you can completely describe the space of Higgs fields, or the cotangent bundle to moduli of bundles, in terms of these spiral covers, in terms of this integrable system, goes back to Hitchin and Atiyah, and then it was taken up in several papers, one by Beilinson Kajdan, one by Faltings, a couple by me, and then pretty much the complete result is in this paper with Dennis Geitzkori. So let me just show you the ancient approach. So you look at the Lomon paper, you look at the Hitchin paper, and you think, how can you put these two things together? So I told you yesterday that in the abelian case, Langlands is easy. The Hitchin system gives you a way of converting questions that are non-abelian questions, questions about moduli of bundles, to abelian questions. Abelian varieties, line bundles, those are abelian things. So how do you put them together? Well, here's one way. Let's do it just for the group GLN for simplicity. That's certainly the way I was thinking about it back then. So you give yourself a local system. Blackboard V is the pair, the vector bundle V in a flat connection nabla. If L is a line bundle on some spectral or cameral cover, you can take its image, its direct image downstairs, that's going to be a vector bundle downstairs on the curve C. And turns out you can reverse it. This, given the vector bundle V, you can pull it back to the spiral cover, and from the definition of the spiral cover in terms of eigenvalues of this moving Higgs field, you can use that to decompose each fiber. So you have your vector bundle V over the curve C. You can find you can take the pullback of V to C bar, to the spectral cover, and notice that it decomposes into a sum of lines, one at each of the points of the spectral cover. So I'm saying it now in the GLN language. If you want to say it for all groups, you have to use somewhat more complicated camera covers, but it works pretty much the same. So we can find a line bundle L. The geometric picture is that at each point of the curve, phi is an endomorphism of this vector bundle V, or of the fiber here. Well, it's not quite an endomorphism. It's a twisted endomorphism. It takes values not in numbers, but in one-forms. But one-forms are just numbers up to a scalar, so you can more or less ignore them. You can look at the decomposition into eigenlines, and those are the fibers of this line bundle here. You're just decomposing the moving vector space into a sum of n lines, which are eigenvectors, or eigenlines of this moving endomorphism phi. So a slightly fancier way to say it is, you take the map from the cotangent bundle at, the cotangent space at V to bun, that maps to the base B by the Hitchin system. You cross it with C. Over here you have the spectral cover. You pull it back to this bigger cover. This picture is somehow the heart of the construction. So what I'm saying is, we started with a vector bundle V on C. For each choice of spiral cover, and you can do it uniformly in the whole family, you get a line bundle L on a bigger curve, on a cover of the curve. The connection that you had on the vector bundle tries to induce a connection on the line bundle. at a point where you actually have indistinct, independent eigenvectors, you'll really get an induced connection on the line bundle near those. Problem is that when you have ramification, when your curve is, when the cover is ramified over the base, which means that some eigenvalue acquires multiplicity, so some eigenspace, generalized eigenspace, becomes more than one-dimensional. At those points, your connection is going to blow up. It'll acquire some singularity. So you have to work with that. You use a little bit of algebraic geometry that tells you that the ramification locus of phi is determined by a junction formula and whatever in terms of some multiple of the canonical bundle. So that tells you that you can make a little correction to the connection and actually make it holomorphic everywhere on a slightly twisted version of the curve. So instead of the original connection nabla, you add half d log of f, where f is some function whose, let's say, zeros are on the ramification divisor and poles are on the inverse image of the canonical divisor. So you have to play with this a little bit. The reason you get a half here is because you just do a local calculation and you see that this connection is going to blow up. It'll have a first order pole with residue 1/2. So you subtract half the residue and you get something which is now holomorphic. So there's a direct way of producing a holomorphic connection on a line bundle on the spectral cover. Okay, so now you use the case, the abelian case of GL1. That tells you that given a line bundle on a curve, which is now the spectral curve, you are allowed to spread it over the Jacobian of that spectral curve, or if you're in fancier cases, you can do it on the prim. So you get a line bundle, L tilde, nabla tilde, on the relative Picard, which is exactly the fiber of the Hitchin. And since I'm doing it uniformly over the whole base, I get a line bundle with a connection on the whole total space of the Hitchin system, which when restricted to each fiber is going to be a flat connection. Doesn't mean that it's flat globally. It will have curvature. It just says that the fibers are, again, Lagrangian for this curvature. So you push it down to Higgs and you get some sort of a meromorphic local system along the fibers over the base. So in case it helps, let me try to give an explicit formula for what the fiber of this vector bundle is going to be. So let's work at a point of Higgs, which is given by a vector bundle E and Higgs field psi. So I'll take E and psi to be a fixed Higgs bundle and V phi to be another variable Higgs bundle. So the fiber of this automorphic object at E psi is going to be a direct sum of lines. The direct sum is over all phis, which are in the cotangent space at V to bun, and have the same Hitchin image. Right. So what I'm saying is, I'll show you the picture in a second, but I have E and psi, and I have the Hitchin map of that, which gives me some point B in the base, and I'm looking, and now I give myself another bundle V, and I'm looking at the set of all phis on it, such that H of V phi is the same B. So the question is, what's the degree of this map? How many such phis there are? And the degree is this number that I wrote on this board yesterday. It ends up being 2 to the 3 G minus 3 if the group is SL2, and then for SL3 it's that times 3 to the 5 G minus 5 and so on. So exactly the right number, which is predicted to be the rank of the automorphic sheaf that you're expecting, arises as the degree of the Hitchin map, which is the first strong indication that there really is a connection between them. So I take a sum over that many objects, the objects in this fiber of the Hitchin map, of lines, where what I'm doing is I'm saying if E psi corresponds to some line bundle M on the spiral cover, and L phi and V phi corresponds to some line bundle L, I can pair these two line bundles to get a line. What in the world does that mean? Well, what it means is that over the product of the two copies of the Picard group, there's a natural line bundle. The natural line bundle has a name. It's called the Poincaré bundle. So there is a natural line bundle on the product of the Picard with itself, or a better way to say it, the Picard and its dual. So that means that given any pair of line bundles, you can assign to them a line, which is the fiber of the Poincaré bundle. So that's what this recipe calls for. So here's the picture I promised. Heke is a correspondence, in other words, a subvariety of the product of bun and bun cross C. It's a set of triples, VV prime, X satisfying something. So here they are. What I'm really doing here is I'm defining an abelianized Hecke correspondence. That is a correspondence not between bun and bun cross C, but between Higgs and Higgs cross C. What is it explicitly? An element of Higgs is a pair of V phi. An element here is V prime phi prime. I still have a point X. I want the same diagram as before. You know, it's an isomorphism from V to V prime away from the point X. The only change is I require that it be compatible with the Higgs field, which makes all the difference in the world, because while the Grassmannian, the fiber here was a Grassmannian, so it's a big variety, the fiber here is finite. It's just a collection of subspaces that are invariant under some generic endomorphism. So it's those subspaces that are direct sums of eigenlines. So there's just going to be some like n choose I binomial coefficient possible i-dimensional subspaces. So you're replacing a continuous space of solutions by just a finite collection. So if you unwind it, and for time reasons I better not try to do it, you see that this V tilde that I wrote for you on the previous transparency has an automorphic property with respect to this abelianized Hecke tilde. I've been doing this for the group GLN. I promise that it can be done for all groups. In order to state it for a general group G, what I really need is an analog of the Poincaré line bundle. That was the crucial ingredient. In order to define this bundle on the Higgs moduli space, I needed a Poincaré line bundle. When you unwind, what that means, it means that there should be a duality between the fibers of the Hitchin system for the group G and the Hitchin system for its Langlands dual group. And that turns out to be correct. So a result from a couple of years ago with Tony Pantev is that these two integrable systems are indeed dual to each other in the sense that there's a canonical isomorphism from, let's say, a smooth fiber of one to the dual of the corresponding smooth fiber of the other. If I have a minute at the end, I'll just say something about the argument. But the more interesting question is how close does that bring you to the two geometric Langlands. So how do you go from here? Well, one thing you can do is try to average over all phis. You have some statement, you've constructed something over the Higgs moduli space. You want to go down to bun, so somehow you want to figure a way to integrate over the fiber. Well, that doesn't turn out to be a very obvious thing to do, at least I've never been able to do that. So another way is to deform it to understand in which way this statement in the purple box is the classical limit of the geometric Langlands, which is, so you think of geometric Langlands as a quantum statement, there's some parameter in there, you can let that parameter go to zero, you get the classical limit, and that turns out to be exactly the thing that we know how to prove. So then the question becomes, can you follow this correspondence under the deformation? And there is some very serious work by Arinkin and others where they are trying to carry that out. I'm not sure how hard that's still going to be. In the remaining time that I have, I'd like to talk about the third approach, which uses Simpson's non-abelian Hodge theory. So what is non-abelian Hodge theory? It says that the moduli of Higgs bundles is closely related to the moduli of local systems. Well, we already said that local systems only capture the topologically trivial bundles, so let's put a zero here for the connected component. And what they really tell us is that these two spaces have a natural diffeomorphism. They really are isomorphic to each other as C-infinity manifolds. Not as algebraic varieties. As algebraic varieties, there's some deformation going on. It's true very generally for M, let's say, any compact Hilbert manifold. In our case, we'll take M to be Bunn, and in a minute we'll need M tilde. We'll take that to be the cotangent bundle to Bunn, which is Higgs. So we'll apply it to either of those two. And we'll apply this to a correspondence. We have the Hecke correspondence and the lifted Hecke correspondence, one of the bundles, one of the Higgs bundles. So the key is that we have these equivalences. Sheaves on M tilde, which is the cotangent bundle to M, which are finite over the base, so they hit only a finite number of points in each cotangent space, are the same by the spiral construction as Higgs sheaves on M. So this is one of Simpson's theorems. It gives you an explicit, and it's fairly elementary way to go back and forth between those two. The deep theorem, which is the heart of non-abelian Hodge theory, tells you that these Higgs sheaves are also equivalent to local systems on M. So a local system on M is functorially, categorically equivalent to a Higgs sheaf on M, which is the same as a sheaf on M tilde, which is very sparse, has finite support over the base. H acts on these two. H tilde acts on these guys. And the point is that these actions are compatible. To understand that, you have to really understand the difference between these actions. So I've sort of hid that in the notation. I just told you that in both cases you pull back and push forward. But the nature of the push forward is very different, because in one case you're pushing forward over a finite cover. In the other case, you're pushing forward over some bundle of Grassmannians. So you really need to take higher cohomology. So a lot of, at least the algebraic aspects of this non-abelian Hodge theory go into understanding exactly why that statement is true, that the H tilde action on the cotangent bundle is exactly compatible with the action of H on M. So there's a very obvious recipe. You start with V tilde, which is an eigensheaf of this lifted Hecke on M tilde. And now instead of trying to deform, you just say that that eigensheaf is equivalent to an eigen-Higgs sheaf on M. And then you use non-abelian Hodge theory to convert that to a local system on M. And it looks very promising. The problem with this is, if you remember, the condition was you needed a compact Kähler manifold, and these things aren't. These local systems that we get are defined only on Zariski open subsets in M, because you have to impose stability conditions. And they tend to blow up along some divisor. And therefore, the project was stuck for a long time because non-abelian Hodge theory just didn't apply. The exciting news in the last couple of years is that non-abelian Hodge theory has been extended to deal with a wide class of non-compact objects. Not all of them, unfortunately. There still are some conditions, and checking them seems to be very difficult. So that's where things are right now. But basically, due to work of Mochizuki as well as many other people, including Simpson himself, and both Bolch and Picard, and Hertling and Sabah, and Yost, Yang, and Tsuo, Mochizuki is sort of the central name here, have extended this correspondence between Higgs bundles and local systems to the non-abelian case under fairly general circumstances. The key issue in applying this here is to understand the locus where these local systems that you seem to be getting blow up. And that consists of bundles which are stable, but not very stable. What is very stable? Well, you have the Hitchin map from Higgs to a base B. You take 0 here, and you take the fiber over it. Let's call it N for nilpotent. It's a set of all nilpotent Higgs fields, fields whose characteristic polynomials are identical to 0. And you project it down the other way. Higgs is basically the cotangent bundle of Bunn, so you map that to Bunn. Turns out that this N is a Lagrangian cone. So that it's a homogeneous Lagrangian subvariety. So it's a finite union of strata, each of which is the conormal to some subvariety. One of those subvarieties is the zero section, which maps onto all of Bunn. Throw that away. All the other strata are going to be conormals to proper subvarieties of Bunn. So take the union of all those subvarieties. Those are going to be the bad guys. So you say that a bundle is very stable if the only nilpotent Higgs field on it is the zero Higgs field. The non-very stable ones are the ones that are in the image of one of the other strata. We need a good name for the ones that are not quite very stable, so we call them wobbly. They wobble, but they stay stable. The state of the art is that if one can get a precise description of the wobbly locus in the moduli of bundles, that seems to, if it gives the right description, then that will give a, here I have the description of the normal cone. So that together with the current state of non-abelian Hodge theory seems to be pointing towards a hopeful proof of geometric Langlands. So I just had to mention, and this was supposed to be quite a bit earlier in the talk, that there's some very exciting recent physics input from Witten, Kapustin, Sergei Gukov, Ed Frankel, and a couple of other people, where the totality of this input is that the geometric Langlands conjecture can be interpreted in quantum field theory roughly as saying that it's an equivalence between two physical types of topological theories, A brains and B brains, and the equivalence is roughly of the nature of a of a mirror symmetry. And then they have nice names for the operators, our Hecke operators, our Tufte operators, and then the tensorization that we have is called Wilson operators. The relevant part for me is I just want to point out that they arrive through the physics at very similar conclusions, which is that abelianized geometric Langlands is the classical limit of geometric Langlands, but it is also potentially equivalent to the full version. They see it through some sort of a twist or rotation in some space, in intertwining the A brains and the B brains, for me being not very not completely in control of the physics, I take an end run around that and interpret it in terms of what it says in non-abelian Hodge theory. So I was hoping to try to give a more precise sense of how you start from this geometric Langlands, take classical limit, take some explicit parameter down to zero, and get the result that we have, which is the duality between the two Hitchin systems. Let me just say that the key notion is that of a lambda connection. Lambda here is a complex number. A lambda connection is an operator nabla, such that if S is a section and F is a function, nabla of F times S is F times nabla S plus lambda times S df. I forgot an S here. In other words, if lambda is 1, this is supposed to be the Leibniz rule, and you just get a usual connection. If lambda is not 1, if lambda is 17, well, it's equivalent to a connection. So for any non-zero lambda, you get the notion which is equivalent to that of a connection. But when lambda equals 0, you get a completely different thing, which is exactly the notion of a Higgs field. It's just a one-form valued endomorphism. So this is the basic ingredient in Simpson's theory. He follows this flow, letting lambda go from 1 to 0. That's how he gets that connections in Higgs fields give you diffeomorphic moduli spaces. As lambda goes to 0, very roughly, the space of local systems specializes to Higgs bundles, while the notion of a D module specializes into a SIMTX module. You need to the ring of differential operators has a filtration whose associative graded is the symmetric algebra on the tangent bundle. So that is what you get in this limit. So this is what's happening on one side of Langlands duality, this is what happens on the other. So the classical limit, well, on one side you replace the space by its limit, which is Higgs bundles. On the other side, you replace the notion of a sheaf, a D module, by something on in the symmetric algebra. So you get this limit, which is what we're calling the classical limit. Of course, I'm cheating here a lot. For example, you don't really see the intersection chains come in. So there are a lot of fine points. So anyway, the classical limit conjecture is that there exists this equivalence of categories between Higgs bundles. There are categories of Higgs bundles on both sides. One was the original group, one was the Langlands dual group, and it should be compatible with Hecke's and so on. So these objects should be Hecke eigensheaves. And our result is that this is true at least for smooth fibers. So the including singular fibers does not seem to be a trivial extension, and this is still open. And I've given a list of partial results and related results along the way. So I think that it's time to conclude. We're not going to talk about the proof of this. So we have a result. The result is that the Hitchens system has a built-in self-duality. We have an interpretation of that result as a limit of the geometric Langlands conjecture or program. And we also have a dream, which is that it's not just a limit, but it actually is equivalent to the geometric Langlands via some refinement of non-abelian Hodge theory, which seems to be very close at hand. So maybe in a few years I'll have more to report. But for now, thank you.
Thanks very much for your lecture, Ron. Are there questions? Other suggestions? Well, under those circumstances, thanks again for the two lectures. And I'm looking forward to the continuation of the story. A happy ending.
So now you know all about geometric Langlands. Now you know all about geometric Langlands.